But as you might have noticed, there was some technical issues. But I think now we are all set and fine to go. My name is Benno Gammel. I'm a member of the steering committee of this ARMS conference. And it's my pleasure to chair and partake in this discussion about migration and diaspora this afternoon. One thing, very sadly, one of the papers was cancelled. Alfred Russo and Marina Shevcheva couldn't make it to Berlin. Unfortunately, they're doing what they are were presenting is kind of refugee stories, people from the territories that used to be the Soviet Union, queer people who are now refugees in different countries. They are taking their stories and turning them into comics. But they are not presenting this to us today. But we have two other really fantastic papers, one on Nordic migration. Elsie is going to go first, and then Sean is going to talk about rainbow refugees, rainbow pilgrims, and the projects they're doing in the UK primarily, but not only. I was just going to say by way of starting this that as we only have two papers, it's going to be a bit more relaxed. So we start a bit late. And we're also going to have, after each paper, we're going to have questions to the papers directly. And I hope that in the end, after we had both papers and discussions in both papers, there's still time left to then once more open the floor for comments and questions about migration and diaspora, refugees. How do we represent these kinds of stories, images, and experiences within the broader context of queer ARMS, and what are kind of interesting methods and questions. So I hope that in the end of the session, we're going to have a broader discussion that then kind of, you know, once more brings all of you into conversation with one another as well. So with that, I will just quickly introduce the first speaker, Elsie Hyttinen, who comes from us from the University of Turku in Finland. She has been doing research on working class literature and on Finnish-American migration, among other things. And you find more information, I just keep the introduction short, you find more information in the program. You also actually find the abstract of the paper and more biographical information. But I leave it at that, and I now look forward to Elsie's paper on Nordic queer migration, flows of people and ideas from Finland to Sweden and Iceland to Denmark. Thank you very much, and welcome, Elsie.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, but a bit scary as well, because the room is so big. But we'll see how it goes. So I'll be talking about Nordic queer migration during the latter half of the 20th century, from Iceland to Denmark and from Finland to Sweden. And I figured I would start with a visualization. And as you see, there's an oddly shaped arrow from Iceland to Denmark and from Finland to Sweden, or Stockholm to be more precise. And I'm kind of hoping that by the end of my paper, you'll understand how apt visualization this is, because the outlines of the arrows are barely visible. They're quite thin. They are rainbow colored, but they are quite thin, and the shape is odd. And it kind of is a visual metaphor for the kind of understanding or knowledge we have on the phenomenon I'll be talking about today. Everybody knows it exists, but nobody has done any research on it. So we don't actually know the shape of the arrow. I'm not presenting my own work today. I'm kind of presenting a collective dream of a group of researchers. The core project members met last June in a history conference in a panel on queer history in the North. We didn't talk about this topic. We all had our different topics. The Icelandic researchers were sitting there, Iris Ellenberger, Asta Kristin Benediktsdottir, and Hafdis Erla, who is not here. And Finnish researchers were Tuula Juvonen, Riikka Taavetti, who is not here, myself, and Anu Koivunen, who is not who's also not here. But we had fun in that panel. And in off-panel discussions, we quickly identified similarities in what we had kind of thought were our nationally specific histories. So we had an understanding of how things in Finland went, and the Icelanders had an understanding of the Icelandic history. But when we started comparing our understandings, we actually saw like patterns emerging that actually might have more to do with dynamics of peripheria and a center than our national peculiarities. And that was a healthy reminder of the importance of transnational approach in studying queer history. One of these similarities we identified was that there was this migration flow from Iceland to Denmark and from Finland to Sweden that was widely known but undocumented. It was kind of history hiding in plain sight in the sense that it disappears in other narratives of migration. In Finland, there was a big migratory movement from Finland to Sweden in the 1960s because of work. And that movement has been narrativized mostly in terms of working class history, in terms of a Finnish countryside no longer being able to make small farms affordable and stuff like that. So there was no space or no narrative for migration happening for other reasons at the same time. And for Icelanders, Denmark and Copenhagen always represented, I suppose, like a chance for more urban life than would have been possible in the Icelandic context. So we came up with this project plan, and sadly, by the time we submitted the abstract for this paper, we were hoping that we'd actually be launching our project here, but we aren't. We are still looking for funding, so I have actually no results yet to present. So rather, I'm here to talk about our rationale and why the queer side of intra-Nordic migration matters. In comparison to many other regions, the Nordic countries are considered sexually permissive and equal. Being gay-friendly is today a given part of how Nordic countries are branding themselves as distinctively tolerant. However, a closer look at the historical attitudes toward homosexuality complicates this picture. Whereas Denmark and Sweden decriminalized homosexual deeds early on in 1933 and 1944 respectively, Finland only joined its neighbors in 1971. This marked difference in attitudes towards homosexuality resulted in a tremendous pull factor for young Finnish gay men and lesbian women who sought for possibilities to live out their sexuality. This led into a remarkable yet closeted queer migration from Finland to Sweden from the 1960s onwards. And although Iceland followed Denmark's lead with decriminalization already in 1940, in a small country, the change of attitudes did not follow the legal renewal evenly. Hence, also many Icelandic gays and lesbians sought their personal luck rather in Denmark than in the close confines of their small communities. This history of Nordic queer sexual migration from the peripheries to the metropoles from the 1960s to 2000 is something that has not yet been studied in any of the countries mentioned here. While previous migration research has scrutinized uneven economic, social, and regional developments for migration waves since World War II, the change in immigration policies of Scandinavian countries, as well as issues of multiculturalism and even gender, the meanings of sexuality for migration processes have been left unexplored. Andrew Shields' Immigrants in the Sexual Revolution being an important exception and a first step to this rule. The study was published in 2017. Internationally, of course, internationally, however, queer migration and the sexuality of migration has emerged as a new and vital research field during the last decade. Since 1990s, US, Latin American, Asian, and UK scholars have investigated sexuality as a dense transfer point for relations of power, structuring all aspects of international migration and immigrant experiences. Beyond this, scholarship on sexuality has started to explore how migration and transnationalizing processes are centrally implicated in the construction, regulation, and reworking of sexual identities, to quote Labhede. With this research project, we wish to integrate Nordic migration history into these international debates, revising the age of migration, to quote Stefan Kastels and Mark J. Miller's term, through the lens of sexuality and sexual minorities. Mapping and analysing transnational flows, the who, when, what, where of non-heterosexual migrants, and memories, we reconstruct lost histories of migration that have been invisible and closeted in social memory and silenced as a research topic. So, if we ever get the funding, our first or our most important objectives are: we want to make a distinctive contribution to the existing historical, sociological, and ethnological research on Nordic migration, because the rainbow-colored thread in that history doesn't exist at the moment. We want to make visible alternative histories of vulnerability, relationality, social networks, and intimacies. We want to open up new perspectives to studies of urbanization and central-periphery relations in the Nordic countries. And we want to revise existing national inward-looking histories of sexual minorities, as well as Nordic success narratives of social equality and sexual permissiveness. Reconstructing lost histories of migration, we produce new knowledge of Danish, Finnish, Icelandic, and Swedish LGBTQ and queer histories through a transnational lens. And our sort of core hypotheses are that while same-sex relationships figure as prominent theme when discussing contemporary transnational migration flows in the post-9/11 world, for example, as a ground for humanitarian visa, we suggest that queer migrancy has a longer history, also within Nordic countries. Here, we focus on the period of mediatized sexual liberalization from the 1960s to 2000, when registered partnership for same-sex couples was introduced in Finland. Secondly, we hypothesize that social hierarchies, both in the sending and receiving countries, condition the histories of queer migration. We also assume that queer migration is formative and generative for both the migrants and their sending and receiving countries and communities, and we assume that examining queer migration entails reviewing the histories of ideas, how ideas of sexual equality have traveled, as well as of alternative forms of social and intimate relationality in a broader sense. Our research questions, or the topics we think we should be focusing on, are: what role did non-heterosexual orientation play in the decision to migrate within the Nordic region? How did non-heterosexual orientation affect integration and settlement in the new host country? What were the social and cultural effects of migration in both the sending and receiving countries? And what role have LGBTQ networks and organizations played in the migration and integration processes? In the project, we examined the scale, quality, and modes of queer migration, how the receiving countries dealt with non-heterosexual migrants, and how the existing social hierarchies and historical legacies were played out in that process. We are particularly curious to learn how intersecting differences such as gender and class informed mobility and settlement, as well as information of new socialities and grouping. When looking at the questions of settlement, we focus in particular on the queer migrants' inclusion in education, labour and housing market, and their position in the healthcare, something especially in the AIDS crisis of the 1980s to mid-1990s made vitally important. Finally, drawing from oral history and media and literary representations, we examined the social and cultural memories and the affective histories of migration, of leaving, moving, and belonging. The original team that met in that Women's History Conference a year ago consists of researchers from various fields of various research fields. I am specialized in literary theory and Finnish literature, but there were also people specialized in Icelandic literature, in migration history, in queer history, and we were trying to come up, or have been trying to come up with a plan where we would make the best use of the expertise we have. So the frameworks within which we are kind of moving are as follows. We draw and contribute to queer affect and memory studies, and methodologically we rely on textual analysis and oral history. We benefit from migration studies. It provides us with a framework for researching the causes, processes and outcomes of queer migrations from Iceland and Finland to Denmark and Sweden. Its strong emphasis on highlighting asymmetrical relations between sending and receiving countries provides this project with a solid groundwork for exploring hierarchies within the Nordic region and their effects on Nordic queer migrations. Queer studies allow us to ask how gender affected the ways in which sexuality, sexual identities, and sexual relations became structured in the process of migration. As the family ties based on blood relations and marriage were left behind, it is well possible that queer sexuality helped to create other kind of familiar ties with within migrant communities and in relation to queer subcultures. Literary studies. Literary depicting migrancy can illustrate what, at a given moment, is imaginable within the confines of literary genres, topoi, etc. For the contemporary audience, literature touching upon sexual migrancy can be approached as an archive of feelings, a repository of culturally conditioned ways of giving a narrative form to the complex ways sexuality and affect intertwine with the reality of moving to another country. Oral history research. This is a very important aspect. of this sort of dream project, because if we're talking about migratory movement that took place during the latter half of the 20th century and especially during the 1960s, now is the moment to conduct interviews with those people. This is the momentum. Oral history research provides us theoretical and methodological tools to analyze the memory work occurring when the past migrations are addressed in interviews. Moreover, the perspectives on cultural memory are needed to understand how the cultural narratives of migration have been formed, as we claim, to omit sexuality as a salient region behind migration and as an element affecting the integration. So we have this class narrative about migration, but we don't have a narrative that would seriously take into account sexuality. And affect studies provide us perspectives on social relations as effectively charged and emotions as embodied, socially meaningful and culturally resonant. Focusing on the affects of migrations, migration entails unraveling the contradictory meanings of leaving and settling, as well as the histories of shame and pride informing queer memories. So many questions, so many aims. What data could ever answer these? Well, no single set of data. Our multiversal data consists of archives of lesbian and gay organizations, print media, fiction published in the forms of books or films, oral history interviews, campaigns to collect written life stories and memories of queer migrants. Our multiversal data will help us to study the issue of queer migrations from various perspectives. And one day, through this multiversal data, it is our hope to write a chapter of the 20th century Nordic history, a new chapter of the 20th century Nordic history, a chapter that actually acknowledges the existence of the phenomena we're calling queer migration, and also acknowledges the push and pull factors behind it, so that we will finally get to draw those arrows in a way that sort of respects and makes visible the experiences of people that fit or that sort of are behind those arrows. Thank you.
So thank you very much for this wonderful paper, Elsie. There is a lot of issues around urban, rural, center, periphery, queerness and homemaking. But as I said, we now have like 10 minutes for questions directly to that paper. This is also the moment where I will should have said that in the beginning there is translation. So Carsten, right? Hello. If you want to get headphones, you can get the German translation as well. But I think in terms of questions, you can ask your questions in German or English. You would understand Finnish, I assume. So there we go. Oh, and there is, I think, AJ and Robins, if I remember correctly, who have microphones. So if you want to say something, ask a question, make a comment, just give us a sign, wait for the microphone, and there you go.
Thank you for the great presentation. I have a question. It's a bit, I don't know, maybe you can consider it out of the topic, but it's migration and it's in Nordic countries. Did you consider working on the refugee crisis in Nordic countries, like people coming from Syria, from Turkey? Because I wasn't, for example, and this is, it touched me a lot. I was in Europe right last year in Stockholm, and I was very shocked to not see the refugee community integrated in the Europe Ride. And I talked to some of the refugees I know there, and they told me that such they were shocked, culturally shocked, because probably, you know, in the MENA region, the culture of LGBTQI plus is very different from the one in Nordic countries. And according to them, there is no infrastructure that can integrate them into the community and help memorizing their or documenting their memory, because the culture is very different. So my question is, did you think of working on that, and is it part of your strategy, maybe on a long term? And that's it. Thank you.
I think that the topic you're bringing up is vital. It should be studied. I think there are initiatives in Finland to study this. There's a person in the audience nodding, so there is, because, yeah, she's a trustworthy source on this. But our project, unfortunately, would be focusing mostly on 60s and 70s and kind of intra-Nordic migration. So it's a very different kind of framework, even though I'd almost say that the phenomenon you're talking about is more urgent at the moment. That's what we should be focusing on. But our project is like intra-Nordic queer migration, because that's also, even though it's not as urgent as the migration crisis in Europe at the moment, it's also an invisible part of the Nordic history, and it should be studied, if only for the reason that the Nordic countries are so branding themselves now for tolerance and sexual permissiveness. And it's kind of important to remember what the very recent history was like, if you know what I mean.
Thanks for your presentation. I hope the funding comes through. I'd be interested to learn on the results. My main question is if you can say a little bit more about the periodization. There are a couple of details you gave around, I guess, the latter date being tied to when same-sex partnerships were legal. But can you say more about why 60s and 70s, maybe not 50s and 60s, or some more details around that, please?
That's a very good question, because we maybe should actually start with the Second World War. But the emphasis on 60s comes from that decade being, like 60s and 70s being like the decade of Finnish migratory movement from Finland to Sweden. And there being no such clear shape or curve in Iceland, I think that's how we kind of ended up with this periodization, that it plays an important role in Finnish history. But you could actually say something about Icelandic history. Is there a pattern that makes 60s, 70s more important than other periods of time?
Do you hear me? Yeah. I think when you look at this, the periodization from an Icelandic perspective, the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s makes sense, because that is the period when homosexuality is kind of emerging as a kind of Icelandic phenomenon, like in the Icelandic media, which is followed up by like homophobia and, you know, conditions that make people want to move away. And this is also like the period when like the people that we know about that moved, that is the period when they were migrating. So from the Icelandic perspective, that period makes sense.
Yeah, and 60s, 70s, 80s is a period, like, as you said, those people are still there, that you can interview them, you can conduct, like, that is history that we can still kind of reach, we can reach those people, yeah.
Thank you very much. Mocht, as I've seen you, Jona, Mocht, so the next question, please.
Hello, I'm Ahmed. Thank you for the presentation. I wanted to ask a question about the oral history part because it's kind of similar to what we're doing with our project. And my question, we have ideas of how we're going to reach people, because like you said, people are still alive, so now's the time to interview them, to record that. And we have some ideas of how we're going to do that. And I was wondering, how were you thinking of reaching out or finding them, or... So, because you know they're out there, but how are they going to find you, or how are you going to find them? What was your plan for that?
Partly, I think we don't have the funding yet, so we haven't started laying our sort of nets anywhere. But partly, we are kind of, I think, relying on people who are connected to a project. Being very sort of well connected with the LGBTQ communities in Finland, and people sort of already trusting them, and we can start spreading word, and also we have like personal connections to people who have migrated, and we could start like building from there. How have you solved this? It's a question of trust, very much.
Yeah, we haven't like solved it yet. We're working. We're starting our project. Actually, it focuses on Somali queer presence and past. And what we're doing, one of the things is I'm very vocal on Twitter. I'm very out, and people see me. So I already get a lot of people that reach out to me, and I talk to those people, and then. So it's kind of like word of mouth, but then we're also going to... The first thing we're going to do with our project is do a podcast series. So when that comes online, we'll also do a call out to tell people if you have stories you want to share. It can be anonymous, and for that reason, they can reach out. And that will just hopefully snowball. And just being like very visible on Twitter already gained a lot of people that reach out to me. And yours is like very specific time frame, so it should be like easier in a way, because then people from that time frame can reach out. And for us, it's much broader because it's about Somali queer presence and past, like very broad. So that's Somalia. Oh, all over, like mostly in the diaspora, but also people who live in Somalia. But we also very concerned with security, so. We will start with people who live in the diaspora and who are visible. But we will say, if you want to share stories with us, you're more than welcome. And we'll create a website. That's the plan. We also don't have funding, but hopefully we will.
Okay, thank you. Jena?
Thank you very much for the presentation. It sounds like a really exciting project. And I really like the idea that, you know, despite Nordic countries having this image of being gay-friendly or queer-friendly, some people ended up deciding to move somewhere else, maybe with the hope of finding safety or freedom or a better life. So, but I wonder, why do you focus on intra-Nordic countries migration? So were there also maybe other routes, like were there other people decided to move, you know, to places which are like outside the Nordic regime?
That's very possible, and in fact, yes, of course, like people migrated to the US or England and Berlin. But for instance, in Stockholm or in Copenhagen, they had like a subculture almost. You know, so you could, of course, like have a broader study queer migration from a broader perspective. But what we are trying to make visible is this flow of people and ideas between these countries and how these smaller communities, like you couldn't until 1971 legally, you couldn't have a queer community in Finland because it was illegal. So what you had was a queer community in Stockholm, and this history hasn't been studied. So it is of course interesting and very relevant to ask what is the sort of bigger framework within which this happens, but it doesn't take away the interest of focusing on these smaller kind of subcultures and trying to analyze the dynamics of them.
Can we, okay, one last quick question for you. Or did I overlook anything?
Maybe I can just add, because Elsie was asking me, answering to your question about asylum seekers in Nordic countries, there is a Nordic research group who is also looking for funding for researching that topic. At the moment, asylum seekers in different Nordic countries. So if you know anything about this, or if you are interested or have contacts, I'm talking to you about asylum seekers in Nordic countries. There is a research group which I'm in who are looking for funding for that purpose. So if you know anything, or any one of you knows or wants to know anything about this topic, please contact me. And also another project that I'm doing is trying to find an interview Finnish homosexual people who moved to Berlin in different times. So we are like adding to it other researches, and there are many things you can do.
So we're both from Finland and we know each other, and these, you know, these projects kind of intertwine with each other.
Sorry, I forgot to mention my name. I'm Outi Lepola and I'm working in the Migration Institute of Finland.
All right.
I'm really sorry for not focusing, but a bombing just happened in my capital, of my city, Tunis, and Twitter is on fire. The president of the republic just died, so Tunisia is really on fire.
No, really.
And I want to ask for a minute of silence, if that possible, because three policemen died in the bombing just now, and the president of the republic died just now, so it's one of our bad days, and that's it. Sorry for the bad vibes.
Well, thank you. Difficult now, but yeah, we'll go on with our panel, I guess. And I'll thank Elsie once more for the paper and the discussion. And the next speaker is Sean. Can you bring it up? Sean Knan, who is coming from London, works for the UK charity Liberal Judaism, and is the founder and project manager of a couple of projects, Rainbow Choose, Rainbow Pilgrims, most recently I think Lily's Legacy. Most of them are oral history projects, so we're kind of continuing well, on the topic of migration, obviously, but also on the method of oral history and what we can do with him, with it. Sean is also partaking in, I just wanted to mention that, in the Museums Association's Transformers Innovator Program, but already transformed quite a lot in the world of museums and exhibitions.
And myself as well, yeah.
And, shall we say, public history. So the floor is yours, looking forward to your paper. This is me, Queer Migrant and Traveller Memories, the Rainbow Pilgrims Project.
Thank you. Hi, everyone.
So in this presentation, I will cast a contemplative glance back on my experience working together with the various stakeholders on the oral history and archive project Rainbow Pilgrims, as we heard just now, the rights and passages of LGBTQI migrants and travellers in Britain. The project started in 2016, and it was a 20-month project supported by the National Lottery through their Heritage Lottery Fund. So we did find funding, and it was hosted by the faith-based charity Liberal Judaism, where, and I've been working for this charity for a number of years in various capacities. This project explored the hidden history of LGBTQI migrant and travelling communities of all faiths and none in Britain. And we used, as you can see in the slide, oral history was the main component, but we used also film, photography, illustration, zine making, and other multimedia stuff. And I'll show you one of our data visualizations a bit later. Hopefully we'll have time for that. The outputs were an archive creation, which is at the London Metropolitan Archives. And if you heard in the morning, there was John Pimlet from the London Metropolitan Archives, who I've been working with, the pleasure to work with for many, many years. The London Metropolitan Archives is a wonderful place for queer archiving. So if you ever get to London, there's also a great conference. I'm going to pitch that for Jan and team, which is usually in December, which is a queer archives conference. So please head to London in December. So archive, various learning tools, including an exhibition, both online and please do check out the online exhibition. It's wonderful, just on the Rainbow Pilgrims website, rainbowpilgrims.com. And there's also a booklet, which I have a sample here. We ran out of the hard copies, but you'll find the PDF online as well. And we've had various events, symposia, and other things as well. And outcomes, which I believe we've all reached more and more. We wanted to celebrate and preserve this heritage of migration and travelling communities. There was a learning aspect to this project, hence we produced various materials you can still download. Participation was definitely an outcome that we've achieved. We had training, lots of other skill sharing opportunities for everyone. And above that, we wanted to create, obviously, awareness, enhance visibility about these communities, and create pride and well-being, which I hope you will see in this presentation, that we have achieved that. We'll have, hopefully, those links will be working. When there was a bit of an issue, some clips, both video and audio, for you to get to know a little bit our Rainbow Pilgrims participants. But I'll start a little bit sharing something about myself, because of people, what inspires you to do Rainbow Pilgrims? And, it's a long story, but the real short version is I'm a Rainbow Pilgrim myself, and it reflects essentially my own journey and my family's journey. So I'm an immigrant. I was a migrant for many years. They kicked me out of Australia, asked me in the break why. I was an immigrant to the UK. I became a British citizen this year, right before Brexit. Don't know if that was a good idea, but we'll see. I come from a second-generation refugee family. My family was, we are a diaspora Jewish and Gypsy Roma traveller. We are a hybrid mix, and so we are victims and survivors of the Holocaust. And I take various letters in the LGBTQI plus acronym as well. So, Rainbow Pilgrim. Before we get into the project, though, forgotten about that one. Yeah, here are just some partners. We've had really partners across the sectors, from heritage institutions, but also community groups, refugee groups, Gypsy Roma traveler groups, and so on and so forth. Universities, museums. All across, which I believe is incredibly important for running such a project. But a little bit about the context, especially for people who are not from the UK, I thought I'll give you a bit of an overview about immigration, migration, refugees, and Gypsy Roma travellers. So the UK has always been ethnically diverse, with a population developing from complex historical migration patterns. Immigration to the United Kingdom in the 21st century is larger and more diverse than at any point in its history. Since 1945, immigration to the United Kingdom under British nationality law has been significant. In particular, from the Republic of Ireland, from the former British Empire, especially India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, the Caribbean, South Africa, Nigeria, Ghana, Kenya, Hong Kong, and the Commonwealth, of course. And other immigrants have come as asylum seekers, seeking protection as refugees under the United Nations 1951 Refugee Convention, or from member states of the European Union, which are still allowed in, exercising one of the European Union's four freedoms. You can see I'm not a Brexiteer. Yet not every migrant or racial identity group has always been welcomed and integrated well into British society. And prejudice and discrimination prevails against those who are visible. In the current political climate, racism, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism and homo-trans biphobia are reported, and they are really on the rise, especially after the Brexit vote. And it might be a coincidence, we don't have any particular stats, but there is an indication that that is the case. LGBTQI migrants are among the most persecuted groups and are frequently subjected to violence, harassment and discrimination by members of their own communities as well, by the state, of course, and the public. Despite that, the UK has consistently been recognised as one of the best countries for LGBT plus rights in Europe. UK asylum law is, however, complex, and applications made by individuals seeking international protection are, more often than not, refused by the Home Office. An individual will be recognised as a refugee under the UN Convention relating to the status of refugees if they can establish that they have left their country and cannot return because they hold a well-founded fear of persecution there for, among other things, their membership of a particular social group. This will include, of course, LGBTQI individuals. For the individual applying on the basis of their sexual or gender status, the journey can be extremely traumatic, invasive, and long-winded with no guarantee of success. And we've heard many of these stories with our Rainbow Pilgrims. And some of those participants that we have had, I'm still in touch with them, of course, are still waiting for their asylum to be heard after 10, 15 years. According to the UK government's recent national LGBT survey, respondents who were born abroad often described settling in the UK as a conscious decision because of the discrimination and prejudice they faced in their country of birth and because of the UK's record on a positive record on LGBT rights. This often includes the citizens from the European Economic Area. The term gypsy and travellers is difficult to define as it does not constitute a single homogenous group, but encompasses a range of groups with different histories, cultures and beliefs, including Romani gypsies, Irish travellers and Scottish travellers. Like, for example, my family were actually Sinti Roma, not from the UK, but from Balkans and Central Europe. Contemporary research has confirmed that Gypsy Roman travellers, as we say GRT communities, have suffered an excessive amount of discrimination and are the largest stateless minority ethnic group in Europe. In the UK, the Equality Act of 2010 protects people from discrimination in the workplace and in wider society. Romani gypsies, Scottish travellers and Irish travellers have been declared by the courts to be protected as races under this act. Nevertheless, gypsies travellers continue to face high levels of racial discrimination, contributing to and exacerbating the inequalities they experience. LGBT issues can often remain a taboo within gypsy and traveller communities, which leads to LGBT gypsies and travellers often feeling isolated and in despair. However, in 2017, the Traveller Movement launched a first-of-its-kind initiative in the UK that aims to challenge homophobic attitudes. And in fact, next week, I'm going to the first GRT, Gypsy Roma Traveller LGBT conference in Wales, which is hosted by the Welsh Government, which I think is already an incredible progress. So I can't wait for that. Yeah, but back to Rainbow Pilgrims context. Giving a sense of belonging and connection, religion and cultural spiritual practice often remain an important aspect of migrant and traveller heritage. Yet being LGBTQI plus and from an ethnic minority group can offer up many points of conflict, especially when it comes to keeping religious customs and traditions. Many LGBTQI people within these groups suffer from double, if not triple, marginalisation, and are at times excluded from their own families and faith communities.
Rainbow Pilgrims documented, interpreted, and shared this hidden history so the LGBTQI migrants and travelers of all faiths and none are more visible and can be celebrated as members of the various UK communities and society at large. We want to continue the pilgrimage tradition of telling our stories to those we meet along the way. The key source, as I said, of Rainbow Pilgrims are the 30-plus audio and audiovisual testimonies the core volunteer team collected after training in the first project phase. So, we felt it was particularly important to highlight the experiences of LGBTI refugees from the Global South, countries such as Nigeria and Pakistan, because these appear to be the most prevalent and the most marginalized in the UK. We were conscious to ensure diversity when it comes to age, faith, sexuality, gender, family, ethnic background, and ability. So, for example, also we wanted to make sure that we tick all those boxes, so to say, in the LGBTQI plus acronym, because I always feel when I go to any sort of event or project and it says LGBTQI plus, there's usually no I at all, no intersex, for example. There are very few trans people, if completely left out. There's usually hardly any bi representatives. So I wanted to be a project for really all those acronyms, and not just to pay lip service to as a tokenistic thing, because I felt there is a place for everyone in this project. So it was hard work, but it was worth it. The process, challenges and opportunities. London and Manchester have been central planks of Britain's LGBT plus communities, and our associated groups happen to be located in these geographic areas, so the potential for interviewees was high. However, despite our vast networks that included the various LGBT plus immigration support organizations and inclusive churches, enrolling interviewees was at first harder than we initially expected. It was evident that the potential interviewees needed to gain trust in the project first. Also, many participants were not out or had other issues that prevented them from sharing their story. In particular, LGBTQI plus refugees were worried about the possibility of serious repercussions from telling their story publicly, both themselves and their families and friends in their country of origin. Our best practice resolved some of these fears, for example, by organizing social outings and creative heritage workshops, for example, at the Horniman Museum in London, and we did storytelling through object handling, and not necessarily only connected to LGBTI, but just to be creative, to work with each other, and to open up those channels. And we also offered interviewees the option to remain anonymous, the possibility of alias identities, and we did even in some cases, voice altering in the recordings. And so with all that together, interviewing finally picked up. We used a sort of common semi-structured interview guide, and that was sort of, you know, according to themes that we wanted to explore. And the interviews were mostly in the English language, with one exception that was translated simultaneously by a friend in the interview from the same country, which was Pakistan. And the interviews were transcribed as summaries for archival purposes. However, we included verbatim passages that were useful when we created the exhibition and the booklet and other learning resources. Members of the volunteer core team headed by the curator worked together face-to-face and online, developing the structure and content for the exhibition outputs. And of course, the material itself was highly sensitive. Many participants had faced persecution in their home countries from their communities, including their families, school teachers, neighbors, police, faith communities, and so on and so forth, due to their sexual orientation or gender identity. So we get back to this, but I wanted to introduce to you one of our participants, and the link didn't open, so I'm just have to click out of this. Oh gosh, okay, here it comes, and try to go to the exhibition material directly. Forgive me, it's coming. So this is Raquel. I hope you can read that here, but I'm just going to read it for you. Raquel is still seeking asylum in the UK. And she grew up in Uganda, where homosexuality is criminalized. And she liked, as she said, girls from an early age and first fell in love at school. Okay. no sound.
No video either.
There's no video. This is just an audio oral history.
Very deep, just out of the blue, and she's had it. When I was growing up, yeah, I had a friend. I really, really liked her so much. We went to school together. Yeah, I really liked her. I remember telling her, I wish I was a man. I could have married you, just out of the blue. And she's like, what are you talking about? Yeah, she laughed and she said, this is really mad, but you know, we're kids. So in secondary school, I met this girl. Just thought maybe she's like me, but I couldn't speak out. I couldn't tell her that I feel this way. Yeah, it's really hard. You can't just tell someone, oh, I like girls. If you just open the mouth and say it, it just kill you. Yeah. Yeah, the rumor will spread everywhere. She made the first move. I was so happy.
Going to get back into and leave you a moment to sit with Raquel. The process of oral history, interpretation, and preparation for archival deposit was at times difficult and painful, and many team members were sometimes upset by the materials. Sometimes the interviewees got triggered. Triggered meaning that something set off a kind of flashback, transporting the interviewee back to the event of their original trauma, resulting in emotional reactions akin to the trauma that they experienced in the past. And there's also a really interesting, I hope you can read it, a reference here. There's Dr. Emma Vickers, oral history review article, Unexpected Trauma in Oral Interviewing, if you're interested in this sort of stuff. So the interviews had to be paused sometimes or continued another day, and one interview in particular, which I actually took myself, had to be deleted because the interviewee felt that their story was too traumatic to listen back to. That was a participant from Iran. So it became clear that trauma poses limits and challenges for oral history, forcing considerations of how the interview process itself may be traumatically invasive. So there's another another link here, which is I need a bit longer, sorry. So there's another reference here. Okay, so lacking time, I'm gonna go to another person, Tafadzwa. And this is a beautiful image here from the gay village in Manchester, where we had a photo shoot, which I'm hoping I have time to tell you about. Just Tafadzwa tells you really quickly about how he feels.
I'm in Manchester, in the gay city. I love it so much. Because it's me, it just brings out me, it makes me. Me, it makes me define Tafadzwa as a gay man.
In the UK, you know, I can freely express myself as a gay person without fear or intimidation or persecution, without fear of people criticizing me. I feel home. I just take this as home now.
Yeah, so coming back to those photos, in fact, taken by Suzanne Hakuba, wonderful photographer. So these interviews were shot in London and Manchester in sort of areas that were considered safe-ish and also had something to do with the LGBTQ plus community. And it was really important for some of the sitters that their photo reflected their LGBTQI identity. So, for example, here Tafadzwa just chose this gay village graffiti himself as a background, and he also thought that, you know, he thought about also wearing this particular T-shirt, this particular color. So we didn't really set up anything at all. It was just the parameters geographically. And other than that, the participants really worked themselves on how they wanted to be represented. And that was really one of the key points as well for us. It wasn't like we prescribed it. We actually, people actively created the stories and images themselves, and we just basically facilitated it. But, you know, these are sort of very open and proud photos, and some people, however, just could not participate for the given reasons, but still wanted to have a photo, so we had various ways to do that. For example, to silhouette the photo. So here, this person, his alias is Ray, and he felt that this still represented him. This is sort of an alley where gay cruising and things happened, and there's a nightclub which is called Heaven around the corner. So he felt that was a good way to have his photo taken. But other people felt like here another participant who wanted to be extra out and proud in the gay at the canal street and a gay village in Manchester. And some people, like here we have, which we called the two lovers, because initially they just were too fearful to be on that photo, or that they wanted to have that photo taken. They were, they're still a couple. Oopsie, sorry. Where am I going? I should let go of those buttons. Oh, dear. Where have I gone now? Sorry. How will I get this bigger again? Okay. But then, in fact, funnily enough, after the project, because we had to create so much trust and they'd seen other people, they actually did not want their photo hidden anymore. So now the photo is out and will be actually part of an article in the Oral History Magazine Review Journal, next year in January. And we had also an illustrator, which I think I mentioned before, for those people who either did not have a photo or they felt like their photo was too out. He created illustrations that reflected somehow the people, but they could not be recognized, and that's another thing we did. So here, I said already, for some people it was important to represent not only themselves, but they also wanted to be part of British history and not just their own history. And so I just want to introduce to you JK, who is one of our core members, and in fact he got asylum with the help of Rainbow Pilgrims, because we wrote about 20-30 letters to the Home Office to help people with their asylum application, and JK was one of the lucky ones. He was extremely, extremely excited, and this was though before he got his process.
What you are doing is not allowed, and you're not welcome in the society again. I can't do anything for you. This is it. You can stay where you are, or you can go back and get killed, like your friend. And then he put the phone down.
So this was before, though, but here he was actually extremely happy to be sitting, and this is a statue here of reflecting Oscar Wilde's story. So that's meant to be Oscar Wilde, and JK sat there in the middle of London, and he thought it was great to be able to sit in the middle of London and sit, you know, with a rainbow hat on a statue that represents like a gay icon in the UK. So it really was his connection to British history, and he really wanted that, and he was absolutely happy, and everyone was taking photos of him, you know, like public passing by, and he's like, yes, take photos, this is brilliant, you know, this is who I am and this is me, hence the title of this presentation. Let's go back. I hope I'll find it. Sorry for the flipping around. We also told people to bring objects that connected to their story. And here I wanted to introduce Pliny. This is Trafalgar Square, which is really the center of London. For him, it had the gay connection because the LGBT Pride Parade finishes in Trafalgar Square. So that's where he wanted to be, although it wasn't Pride. And then he was wearing this little rainbow pin. And let me just bring up Pliny. Pliny is originally from Mauritius, and he grew up, and homosexuality was classified as a mental disorder. And I'll play that for you.
Mauritius is quite a small country, very insular, and I think while growing up and knowing a little bit more about my sexuality, I kind of felt very much alone, not knowing if there was anybody else who was gay or LGBT. So from that perspective, it was pretty much sort of isolated, I would say. But while growing up, being a student, there was nothing really for us being gay. There was no place to be safe. There was no completely missed from the media. There was no representation at all. So things have changed now, but like sort of growing up, you were almost completely invisible. I do think it's important to be visible, because from experience and from dealing with people, the people that before have been homophobic, the people that had prejudices, were bigoted, once they've been in contact with somebody who's LGBT, who have seen or they see them around, they see actually, you know, well, yes, they're gay, so what? You know, there is a journey. People do shift, people do change, and it does happen. And I think visibility plays a big role in shifting this attitude. And more importantly, it also gives people some more positive role models. While growing up, I had no positive role model for LGBT. The only role model that I had is, you will die young, you will die of AIDS, you will die lonely.
Yeah, so Pliny and his rainbow pin to be visible, that was another story. And so to the impact, this was Monica, another one of our participants, who chose South Bank to have her portrait taken. And she was one of those participants that was really shy in the beginning and very unsure about things. And she said in our like evaluation afterwards about this photo, the photo session was great. It made me stronger and not fear being shown in the photos in the exhibition anymore. And interacting with people after them, recognizing I am the one in the picture. So it gave her a lot of self-confidence. And I told you really quickly, we had data visualizations. You can check those out on the website. I'm not going to go into it, but we just decided not to do a geographic visualization. We actually decided to do a thematic, so more abstract visualizations of people's journeys. So, yeah, I had mentioned the impact and outcome, so it was a positive experience, a cathartic experience. The rewards would feel more validated for themselves, but also within their communities. Confidence growing, they felt empowered. They helped each other, and the whole team helped each other, which was inspiring for many. And it was many networking and other opportunities, skill sharing, and as I said, also we could help some people with their asylum application to be passed through. But I have not said anything much about our Gypsy Roma Traveller participants, what are particularly important for me, and I have dedicated this talk to Henry Chapman, who was our main Gypsy Roma Traveller, very proud gay man participant and supporter of this project, who sadly passed away earlier this year, a very young, amazing man. Like so many other Gypsy Roma travelers, especially gay men, sadly die, and this death is not necessarily a natural death. So I'm not going to say more, and I hope I didn't trigger anyone. But I want to play really the final thing for you. I hope it works. A video clip with the impact that this has had on Henry.
My name's Henry Chapman, and I'm originally from Eastbourne, but I now am based in Bolton. I'm a massive activist for LGBT rights and for the Egyptian traveller community, because there is non-existent in services, and because we have high rates of suicide within our community, out of any black minority ethnic groups, there are serious problems. So I am trying to push the agenda within LGBT services, Gypsy and Roman traveller services, as well as society, and to try and recognise sexual identity is a massive factor in why we've got these high rates of suicide. I'm here today to film for the Rainbow Pilgrims Project, looking into my history being a traveller, and it's all about LGBT coming out.
The bridge that you can see behind, what do you think?
I
I think that's really good, because there was a black time in my life, wasn't there? It was very, very dark at some point. Even though, like, my life is really colourful now and bright and I'm this person, but that, like, I had very, very dark days at some point. So, a very dark day. So, yeah, so that would be a good point.
Yeah, like a...
But I'm not going to stand there like that.
No. No.
I found out about the Rainbow Project by a person at Parliament. I was launching a video that I was part of with the Traveller Movement around LGBT stuff, and I was approached by someone who asked me to be a main speaker at a conference in February for the Rainbow Pilgrims Conference. When they said, would you come and do a podcast, would you do some filming and stuff and talk about your history and how you got here, I was just really thrilled to be part of it and was happy to say yes. I think the Rainbow Pilgrims is probably the first organisation that's actually want to involve the GRT voice, because they look at all different faiths, religion, cultures, and to be part of that has been amazing. My experiences on the project today has been really surreal. I didn't think I would ever be sitting doing a podcast talking about my history, the narratives of coming out being gay in the GRT community. And it's been able to empower me to have more of a voice in society and to help many other people that I'm trying to reach out to.
I'm going to leave you with my favourite quote from Ray, who you've seen in the silhouette picture. It's very important to be able to voice, to be able to share, to be able to learn, to be able to teach. That's what this pilgrimage is all about. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Sean. I hope nobody minded that we... there was a lot of things to see, don't worry about that, and to hear and to listen to, and there is still a couple of minutes left for questions. So if you have any questions or comments on what Sean just presented, there you go.
Thank you first for your wonderful presentation of this project. My question is, how did you look at a different kind of perspective at the situation of rainbow refugees or rainbow pilgrims and negative stories besides the last story you heard? Because all the other stories were more forcing the negative, traumatized situation in the origin countries, which should be told, definitely, and the positive situation and the change with the migration. But still in the communities, you find a lot of sexism, homophobia, and pressure from the societies as well. How did you cover that in the project?
Yeah, so if you look at the full sort of, you know, materials that we have in the exhibition and the other materials, like the booklet, you will see there's a bit of a balance of both. However, we made a conscious choice to create not just doom and gloom in this project, but hope. Hope was the word that we operated on. And it was not just our choice, as in terms of, you know, the people behind the project, like me, the photographer, illustrator, but it was also the wish for the people themselves. A lot of the, especially refugees, said that they were fed up being asked by the Home Office, by, you know, other sort of people about their story and just telling them the dark details. Whenever I had a media request, the media just wanted to have the gory details and how bad it is and how bad things are. And I said, yes, things are not great and my past is horrible, I know, but, you know, I want to be now. I want to live with hope. I want to embrace what I've got. And this project, you know, with all those amazing people around, is giving me that hope. So we did highlight the issues and challenges, but it's not what we went for.
Yes, in the back there, please.
Cheers. Thanks very much for both your presentations. Sean, this is a question, it's quite a sort of basic question, but I wanted to ask, you have funding from the HLF, right? Is that right? Do they pay for your online exhibition to be kept for a long time after the project finishes, or the kind of legacy of the project? Is that built into the money that they provide for you?
Yeah, if you know that you have to exhibition, have to keep all the materials really alive for 5 years after the project completes, then you have to build that in. In my first project, didn't know that, I didn't build it in, so I'm still paying for that every year. But in this project, I built it in, and yes, so it still pays itself. Thanks for the question.
I mean, there's one other question.
Hi, thank you for your presentation. I'm Keith, and I guess my question is to do about this kind of projects of telling refugee stories. So I'm a refugee myself here in Germany, but I'm based in Munich, and as an artist who's kind of been like practicing for the last 3 years, I get so many requests for projects like this, and not only requests for projects like this, or people who, like, I want to do a documentary on you and your journey and your artist's journey now in Germany. And something I've also noticed with this project and so many other projects that are telling these stories, and I think it comes to do with the question of trust, is there's not only just the side of the doom and gloom of like the past, but I always find there's this whole narrative kind of always being pushed of hope and goodness, of how great it is to live here. And I feel like this is like not nuanced at all. Because my friends who do take part in these projects, I do not do this kind of work for myself, because I can tell my own stories as an artist. But when I'm interacting with them, I'm like, so how was it? They're like, well, we need to tell them how great it is to live here. You know, this kind of thing. And I just wanted to ask you if you're cognizant of this, and if you're to have future projects, how do you plan on kind of getting this nuance out of the subjects, so to speak?
Yes, brilliant question, and thanks for sharing your story. And it resonates with a lot of the stuff that we were discussing and hearing, you know, listening to people. Listen is actually the word. Obviously, there were parameters we had to set, but how I, as a founder of various sort of intersectional, if you want to call it, projects with, you know, so-called marginalized communities, I don't particularly like that term. I'm somebody who works organically. I don't prescribe things. I really wanted to listen to the people, how they wanted to tell their stories, what they wanted to talk about. So we didn't come with, like, you know, mic in your face and now tell us you're happy, or now tell us you're not happy, or whatever. It was literally people. We had, as I said before, we had, for example, workshops before that, just to get to know each other, to do something else, to hang out, to go to a museum, have an object handling workshop, or do other things. And then sort of slowly going into, okay, what would you like to do, you know, also to do with fun, what would help you? Then people, yeah, we want to have fun, but we also want to have home office letter. We want to have materials we can use for our application. And we know there's a variety of things. So we tried to accommodate all of it. None of, you know, obviously some of the stuff, there was, you know, capacity. But to answer your question, I hope it does answer your question, and I hear you. It was really what people wanted. And that's what they wanted. And this is how we didn't know how this is going to look. And in fact, I had a different idea of what actually the stories were looking like than how they were in the end. So organic is the answer.
Can I, if I just may, kind of a follow-up question, and referring to both papers and kind of the broader question of participation ownership, I guess, as well. So, I mean, now you said organically. So how are participants partaken in the project after they said their word, after the interview has been done? Is it an ongoing cooperation? Do they have an influence on how it's presented online? Can they say after 2 years, now I would like to present it differently? Because, I mean, there's also a lot of political questions, right? Kind of in your context, we had the question, how would that such a project impact
migration policies in the Nordic countries now, and in the UK. I mean, you mentioned Brexit, right? I mean, there is kind of is it an ongoing collaborative attempt to also make a political impact, and how could that work in practical terms? Do you want to?
Short answer. Well, there's various things, but I am really happy that despite obviously the official project is finished and funding is officially finished, but I have committed myself because this is very close to my heart, as I tried to explain to you before, my own story and history, to keep it going, not just as an archive, but an actual community. And I'm in touch with almost everyone, you know, those people who want to be in touch. And I get, for example, people have used some of the materials because they're accessible for everyone online and in the archive. There was recently a queer community organization in London did a play, a performance about queer history, and they used some of the materials, and they invited those Rainbow Pilgrims to the play and to take part. So there is stuff happening, creative stuff. So it kind of keeps the community going, and I think that's a beautiful thing. And I appreciate it. It's not always possible, but for me, I just made that commitment.
It's also a question of genres, I suppose. I mean, if you are doing an artistic piece of some kind, then I think people should have more sort of right to later on say that I don't feel that way anymore or something like that. Whereas if you're doing a research interview, then you have to store the material in an archive, and it has to be there. It has to be very verifiable. So it depends on the genres you're working in. I suppose.
Well, yeah, certainly. I mean, I kind of like both answers, because it says kind of one does not have to preclude the other, right? You can do kind of research, and you can still do creative and political work with that as well. Is there more? Yes, please.
My question is, because you're working with communities coming from abroad, from different countries, did you think of making this content that you generate with these migrants accessible to the people in the hometown of that person? Like, for example, if you're working, let's say, with Palestinians in Europe, would you work on making that content produced, for example, in the UK, reachable and accessible to the people in Palestine? Because this is something where there's a gap in this, because it's something in our work in Wikimedia, we noticed that work made by migrants in other countries is not accessible to the ones from their hometowns. That's it.
So in terms of online materials, right? Okay, I don't know, really. Gosh, okay. Well, I know obviously in some countries, like maybe China, they have certain, you know, like, you mean like sort of they can't access, you know, some content, that kind of sort of thing? I'm not an expert on that, and maybe you can help me. I hope it is accessible. I really do hope. However, as I said in the presentation, some people did not want, would have preferred that the content is not available in their countries. So it was a bit of a fine line as well. Some people wanted to be seen, other people didn't want to be seen, and would have preferred if it just stays within the UK or in more Western countries. We tried more in terms of, you know, visibility in the photos and in the audio. So, but it's a really interesting question. I don't know much enough about, you know, that sort of stuff. But maybe we'll have a chat.
Okay. Did I overlook anybody? Because if not, I think that's actually kind of, you know, go on having a chat over the break. That's exactly the thing we're going to do now. And I think it's also a nice way to end this session, to think about how the projects that are done are then kind of, have an impact in different parts of the globe, and how we can deal with that as well. Maybe not necessarily bringing hope, but changing things. Potentially for the better. So this was our session. Thanks a lot for being here. Thanks to Sean and Elsie, and for everybody else who helped to bring this panel together. It is now a 1-hour break. So, you know, time to have your coffee up at the terrace. And then the next session starts at 5 o'clock. I'm also supposed to say that after the dinner break, so at 8 p.m., there is a theater performance here in this space, The Einstein of Sex. And that's kind of, I think, what will keep us going for today. Thank you very much for being here, and enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you very much.